could lead one to embrace it. They thought that a completely new approach to philosophizing was needed. These thinkers went back to Kant's dilemma, in which you could have either metaphysics or logic. They decided that philosophy had chosen the wrong path and decided to reject metaphysics and embrace logic. This was the birth of analytic philosophy. These early philosophers developed the symbolic logic we now use, and when they applied it to Kant's problems, realized you don't actually run into contradictions. Kant had been sloppy in his language, and a more rigorous treatment was able to expose errors. Einstein had revolutionized the world of physics with the new concepts of space, time, mass, and motion. These philosophers seized the opportunity to examine Newton's theory and Einstein's and rigorously show how these new concepts differed and on what grounds we should accept or reject them. Clarity and rigor in language became their central concern. Many questions that philosophers had been asking for centuries turned out not to be real questions at all, but pseudo-questions. So, what is a question? Well, that's one. It's a request for information. If there is no answer, if the requested information does not exist, then you don't have a real question. If you were to ask me, hey, Steve, what color car does your sister drive? That sounds like a question. People could debate it forever with no one having the true answer. Not because it's a deep question about the nature of being, but because I don't have a sister. It looks like a question. It sounds like a question. But it isn't a question. It's a pseudo-question. And the history of philosophy is littered with similar nonsense concerns. By starting with rigorous, clean, linguistic analyses, we can avoid wasting our time asking and trying to answer pseudo-questions. We must begin every philosophical project by first explicating the object of study. We must understand what a thing is. We must develop a theory of it. If the term theory is generally used in science, this is meant to correlate with it. Once the philosopher has a theory of something, of space, of species, of mind, then it determines which questions are meaningful and which ones are nonsense. Most of the meaningful questions are no longer philosophical, but must be handed over to the physicist, the biologist, or the psychologist to answer. Philosophical theories were meant to dovetail with the work of the scientists. So, there are two different methodologies we see in contemporary philosophy. Roughly, the continental approach examines the social political causes for our believing what we do. The analytic approach seeks rigorous and clean accounts of what we mean by the words we use so we can tell which questions are real questions. The next 8 lectures will examine the analytic approach to philosophy of humor. We'll try to see if there is a successful theory of humor. We'll look at the continental contributions to the field in the next section, where we examine the ethical, social, and political meaning of humor. So, if that sort of philosophical approach is more in line with your interests, be assured that it's coming. But now, we want to consider what a theory of humor should look like. What would count as success? And what are the aims and goals we have in forming one? The two goals of any theory of anything is to posit what philosophers call necessary and sufficient conditions. P is necessary for Q if you cannot have Q without P. Oxygen, for example, is necessary for fire. P is sufficient for Q if P by itself is enough to bring about Q. Decapitation is sufficient for death. Notice that while having one's head removed from one's body is enough to cause death, it's not necessary. One can die from other causes while keeping one's head. And notice that while oxygen is necessary for fire, no oxygen, no fire, it's not sufficient. We have oxygen here in the studio, but no fire. Now, if you can formulate a set of criteria that are both necessary and sufficient, then you have what we commonly call a definition. You know what you must have to get something and what's enough to guarantee that you have it. What we want for each central term we will investigate is the set of necessary and sufficient conditions that define our notion. For us, that means we're looking for the necessary and sufficient conditions for humor. What elements do you need to have an act of humor? What elements together will guarantee that an act is humorous? We're going to look at six proposed theories, each setting out different conditions held to be necessary and sufficient. In order to evaluate them, we check to see if these proposed definitions are too broad or too narrow. When evaluating the sufficiency of a definition, we look to see if it's too broad. A definition for concept X is too broad if it includes things that do not fall under the category of X. Say we want to define the notion of chair. We might propose a thing with legs that you can sit on as necessary and sufficient. But this definition is too broad. There are lots of things with legs that we can sit on that are not chairs. Tables have legs, and we can sit on them, but tables are not chairs. My younger brother has legs, and if my mother wasn't looking, I could sit on him. But he's not a chair because he's a person. This is not to say that no people are chairs. For example, I'm human, and I was the chair of my philosophy department for 6 years. But I digress. The point is that we need to narrow the definition. As formulated, it lets in things under the proposed definition of the word chair that we know not to be chairs. We need to sharpen the proposed definition so it excludes all things we don't want in the set it's designed to pick out. When we check a proposed definition's necessity, we see if it's too narrow. In other words, we see if there are examples of the notion that are left out by the definition. Our definition of chair is not only too broad, in that it includes things that are not chairs, but it's also too narrow in that it doesn't include all chairs. Take, for example, beanbag chairs. They are chairs but don't have legs, so our proposed definition would not allow them to be a chair. That means there are two problems with our definition. This is how we're going to test each of our theories of humor. We will look at the conditions they propose, consider how they draw the line, and see what is counted in and what is ruled out. We will ask if everything that's ruled in belongs in, and we'll look at everything it rules out and see if any of those things should have been ruled in. If you get all and only what you're looking for, then bingo, you have a winner. Then you have a definition that works. We have a successful humor theory. So that will be our methodology going forward. Make clear what the conditions are. Test them to see if they're too narrow or if they're too broad. Now that we have our tools, our measuring instruments, we're left with one last question. What exactly is it that we put under the microscope? If we're creating a humor theory, what is it we're trying to define? Philosophers refer to this as the formal object of study. The philosopher Robert Latta says there are two different approaches to humor theory based on different accounts of what the formal object of study should be. Humor is, generally, a social phenomenon. Someone tells a joke, someone else hears it and laughs, nor does it. Latta points out that different humor theories privilege one side or the other of this relationship. There is what Latta calls the stimulus side views. These take the telling of the joke to be the thing that needs to be examined. Stimulus side views look at things like the linguistic structure of jokes or behaviors one must exhibit in telling jokes. It's in the joking that the essential properties of humor are to be found. Stimulus side views need to decide if the concept of humor is a coherent one or an umbrella notion. A coherent concept will have a single set of criteria which are necessary and sufficient to account for all instances. An umbrella concept, on the other hand, has a number of different concepts that are all grouped under a single overarching concept. Consider the term jade. There are two different minerals with completely different chemical compositions, jadeite and nephrite, that are both considered to be jade. Stimulus side theorists need to determine whether verbal jokes, slapstick gags, practical jokes, improv comedy, impersonations, and so on are all meant to be examples of the same sort of thing, or whether they're various different forms of humor. If the notion of humor is a coherent concept, then we need to have just a single set of conditions that will held to be necessary and sufficient. However, if we take humor to be an umbrella notion, then we need different sets of necessary and sufficient conditions for each specific form of humor. Further, we should be able to say if there's a subset of these conditions that all forms have, or if there's a family resemblance, that is, an overlapping set of properties that may not be universal amongst the whole set. Some may have A and B, others may share B and C, while still others have A and C. Whereas stimulus side theorists look at the telling of the joke and the details of the joke told, the response side theorists contend that the formal object of study in the philosophy of humor is the funny. Funny is a reaction. Funny is what happens in the listener. What is it that happens in us when we find something funny? What is the experience of the funny? What differentiates funny ha-ha from funny strange? Sometimes jokes land, and sometimes they miss. When a joke does not land, the listener doesn't find it funny, and thus, when asked, will say, there was nothing humorous there. Sometimes the same thing will be found funny in one context, but not in another. This means, they contend, that while there was humor the one time, there wasn't in the other. So, we can't look at the thing found funny, we must look at the person finding it funny. Humor, these thinkers contend, is to be found, and therefore studied, in the listener, not in the teller or the thing told. When we set out each of the humor theories, we will examine the first thing we need to see is the formal object of study. Where does the theory locate that which we are trying to rigorously define? There are some analytic philosophers who think the project will be doomed from the start. They follow in the footsteps of Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein helped to launch analytic philosophy with his short book called Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. He didn't give it that title, and frankly, he hated it. He concludes the book by believing that he has solved or dissolved every problem in philosophy. This book, he thinks, ends philosophy as a discipline. Since there was no more philosophy to be done, he retired. He left and became a math teacher. Then, one day, attending a talk in philosophy of mathematics, he realized that he was wrong. Completely wrong. He thought that the analytic project failed for many reasons. There are many words for which there's just no possible set of necessary and sufficient conditions. Yet, we understand them fully and know how to use them properly. Consider the word game. Wittgenstein argues in his second book, Philosophical Investigation, that there are no necessary and sufficient conditions for the word game. Consider a competition between players or teams where each is trying to win. Well, this would include warfare, and war's not a game. So it's too broad. But it also excludes solitaire, in which there's a single player. So it's too narrow. Any attempt to fix the problem, he contends, will leave the problems in place. There is no way to strictly define the notion of game using necessary and sufficient conditions. Some philosophers think that humor is like game. In other words, there can be no successful humor theory. It's a game you can't win. There can be no set of necessary and sufficient conditions that delineate a set that includes all and only acts of humor. Are they right? Is the project we're about to embark upon pointless? One way to find out is to try and see if any of the theories we examine is successful. That's what we shall do. So, to review, we're about to launch on a project in which we're trying to determine the necessary and sufficient conditions for something to be an act of humor. We're trying to find the common traits that all acts of humor share that rigorously and clearly define what it is to be a joke. This is standard operating procedure for a certain approach to philosophy, analytic philosophy. Analytic philosophers argue that historically, much of philosophy is just smart-sounding nonsense. The key to real philosophy is to look at language, to strictly set out what we mean by central terms, and then see what questions we were asking turn out to be pseudo-questions, which questions turn out to be empirical questions, answerable by scientists, and which few philosophical questions remain philosophical. Analytic philosophy of science begins by defining what is scientific. Analytic philosophy of art begins by defining what it is to be a work of art. Analytic philosophy of mind begins by giving an account of what we are to mean by mind. And analytic philosophy of humor begins by defining what we are to mean by humor. When someone says to us, "I was only joking," if we complete this project, we can say, "Yes, you were," or "No, you weren't." But it will also let us take E.B. White's frog and let us see why it is, in fact, a frog, so that when we go out to the pond and see more frogs in their natural habitat, we will know an awful lot about frogs and admire them deeply. But that's if we're successful. This is philosophy. When one philosopher says A, there's always another that says not A. Can this project succeed? Can we formulate a complete and rigorous humor theory? Not all analytic philosophers think so. In our next conversation, we'll look at their objections from analytic philosophers who contend that the entire project is doomed to fail, that humor cannot be rigorously defined, and that there's no set of necessary and sufficient conditions that will do the job. Are they right? That's philosophy. We'll see.
Lecture 10, Superiority Theory.
Lunch, everyone.
Hey, Steve, what did you get?
Greek salad.
You mean more like a geek salad?
Is there any egg in it?
Sure is.
Oh, so egg salad for the egghead professor.
Well, for dessert, you can have some of my nerds.
I'm such a nerd. In grad school, our softball team was called the Home Platonists.
Oof. Keep your day job.
This is my day job.
Yikes.
Historically, the first theory of humor is what we've come to call superiority theory. It's the view that humor is the expression of one's superiority over another. When we tell a joke, we're making fun of something or someone. There's a butt of the joke, and what we're doing by joking about it is diminishing it. The laughter that's generated by our jokes is directional. It's aimed at the butt of the joke. The outcome of any act of joking, if it's successful, is to establish a hierarchy in which the teller of the joke is above the butt of the joke. Let's start by recalling what our goal is here. We want a theory of humor to provide a set of necessary and sufficient conditions to define humor. A condition X is necessary for Y when you need X in order to get Y. That is, there's no way Y will come about without X. By itself, X is not enough to cause Y, but it's a requirement. A condition U is sufficient for V if U, by itself, is enough to give rise to V. We may or may not need U for V to come about. There might be other contexts in which you would find V. But if we have U and U is sufficient for V, then we will get V. For example, oxygen is necessary for human life. Take away the oxygen and the person dies. Oxygen is not sufficient. We can't blow air on a dead body and have the person come back to life, but it's necessary. Having a bucket of water dumped on your head is sufficient to get you wet. It's not necessary. There are other ways to get wet, such as jumping in a pool or walking without an umbrella in the rain. But having the bucket dumped over you will do the trick. When we have a condition or set of conditions that are both necessary and sufficient, then we have a definition. If the conditions are necessary, then when we have that which satisfies them, we will have only the members of the set described by the term. If the conditions are sufficient, then that which satisfies the condition will be all of the instances of the term. If we have necessary and sufficient conditions, then we have all and only those things which are described by the term, and that's exactly what we mean by a definition. We're trying to define humor. So, we're looking for the necessary and sufficient conditions for it. The first proposed definition comes from Plato. Plato was not much for comedy. He held a deep antipathy for art in general, especially theater, but he had special contempt for humor. Plato was, of course, one of the followers of Socrates. We know that Socrates really did live in classical Athens in the 5th century BCE because we have multiple historical sources that mention him. Socrates himself never wrote anything, so we only know of him through other writers. By far the largest body of surviving writings about Socrates are the Platonic dialogues, little plays by Plato in which Socrates is a character. As will happen with historical sources, the accounts of Socrates differ slightly. Bertrand Russell, the 20th century British philosopher, reflects on this by saying that the Socrates of Plato is smarter than the Socrates recalled in the writings of Xenophon. And Russell argues that this is because Plato himself was smarter than Xenophon. But in all accounts, Socrates is a philosopher who walks the streets of Athens making arguments. Recall that the story Plato tells in his account of the trial of Socrates, the Apology, is that a friend of Socrates's went to the oracle at Delphi, a temple to the god Apollo. You could make a sacrifice to the god and then ask a question of the god, and the priest would return with your divine answer. Socrates' friend asked who was the wisest person in Athens, and the god's answer was Socrates. Now, this baffled Socrates because he always claimed to know nothing. But surely the god wouldn't lie. So Socrates went to a man in town who was widely held to be very intelligent, especially by himself.
Hey, man, I'm Socrates. You know anything?
Of course I do.
So what do you know?
I know this.
When you say this, do you mean this or that?
Oh, I mean this.
Well, if it is this, then would it be true that thus or so?
So.
And if it is so, then is it also A or B?
Oh, A, definitely.
So, does A mean this or that?
Well, that. I mean, any fool knows that.
Oh, wait a minute. You first said it was this, not that. Now you were saying it is that, not this.
Whoa. Mind blower. Okay.
Yeah, get your sheet together, kid.
I learned something.
And so, it went case after case. Socrates held that he knew nothing, but he also came to believe that no one else did either. He took the meaning of the oracle to be that he had a divine mission, to keep humans from being too proud. When they thought they had knowledge reserved for the gods, he would be the gadfly, an annoying, stinging insect that would bring them back to earth. So, for decades, Socrates refused to hold any job. Instead, he did the gods' work by going to the agora, the marketplace, every day, and demonstrating that yet another citizen of Athens turned out to be a moron. Now, these were the days before reality television. So, Socrates started drawing quite a crowd. He developed followers amongst the children of the wealthy, who were not merely entertained by his questioning, but who would idolize and emulate him. Among this band of young disciples was Plato. Plato saw Socrates as among the wisest humans to ever live. Socrates' dedication to absolute truth made him not merely smart, but holy. To those in the marketplace left looking stupid in front of the whole town, the view of Socrates was quite different. Eventually, Athenians had quite enough of Socrates' questioning and brought him up on three charges. Atheism, believing in false gods, yes, they're contradictory, and corrupting the youth, which used to be a capital offense, but which pays quite handsomely these days. The trial of Socrates was an event of historic magnitude. Because it was a direct democracy, the juries in ancient Athens would be composed of all who came. being the OJ trial of its day, there were around 500 jurors. Socrates showed that the charges were trumped up nonsense, but contended that he would be found guilty anyway. The real charge, he claimed, was simply telling uncomfortable truths. The populace hated him for carrying out his God-given duty and would condemn him to death, not because he was guilty of the crimes, but because they wanted him gone. He was right. They did. He died. Plato saw this as a crime against humanity, against the gods, and against truth itself. Plato dedicated the rest of his life, trying at first to save all the memories he could of Socrates' conversations. These make up the earlier dialogues. In the later dialogues, Plato takes up Socrates' mantle and conducts his own search for truth, using the character of Socrates as the mouthpiece for his own views. When Plato looks back at the events that led to the tragic killing of the great Socrates, he sees humor as one of the operative factors. Aristophanes, in his play The Clouds, portrays Socrates in a very harsh light as the stereotypical philosopher with his head in the clouds, spouting absurd arguments in a way that shows him to be a pontificating fool, a self-proclaimed know-it-all who, in reality, knows nothing. Aristophanes even has Socrates say that the chirping of crickets is actually farting, and in some translations depicts a lizard defecating in Socrates' mouth as he looks up Mouthagate to study the moon. Plato saw Athenians laughing at Socrates, mocking Socrates, and was infuriated. Here were the inferior denigrating the superior. That is the essence of humor, and it helped reinforce the hatred that led to Socrates' vilification and death. According to Plato, all poetry and theater is harmful because it's an unfaithful representation of the world. The artist claims to be showing truth, but really is showing a self-created circus mirror that distorts reality and thus convinces the audience of falsehoods that seem to be truths. Humor is art that places the butt of the joke beneath the teller. The nature of humor is to diminish the object of the joke. When we laugh at, and one can only laugh at those who are inferior. To tell a joke is thereby to create a false representation of the world in which one elevates oneself above the butt of one's joking. All joking is mocking. Because of the pernicious nature of joking, and because of the disastrous effects it can have when people are left with the false beliefs one acquires from hearing another mock, Plato argues that in the perfect state, all comedy would be bad. A second thinker who adopts the superiority theory of humor is Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes lived during the English Civil War and was a vocal advocate for the royalist side. They didn't win. Picking the wrong side in the Civil War is not a good idea. And Hobbes lived part of his life in exile in France. Hobbes had a notoriously dark sense of human nature. Left to our own devices, he thought, we would live in a state of nature. It's a state of constant war, each against the other, in which life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. We need a strong central government, led by a single absolute ruler to keep us all in line, he thought. This dark sense of human nature shows up not only in our physical interactions with each other, but also in our humorous interactions. Humor, he argued, was the realization of sudden glory. Humor, therefore, has two different parts. The first is a sense of glory, that is, of superiority. To claim glory is to have triumphed over someone else, to have vanquished an inferior. And that is what we do in humor. Again, to joke is to mock, and to mock is to put someone or something else down beneath their level. Laughing at a joke is always laughing at someone. But for Hobbes, that acknowledgement of glory has to arise suddenly. There must be a sudden realization. This is the first time in the history of humor that we find a reference to what we now call timing. For a joke to be a joke, for a joke to cause laughter, the realization of one's superiority must arise suddenly. Consider the insults at the beginning of this lecture. It was a role of Steve is such a nerd joke. Now, when we call someone a nerd, we're insulting that person. But the insult is strange, right? It's an insult for someone who is smart, and smart is good, isn't it? When you're in the presence of a smart person, you might feel insecure. You might feel inferior. But the insult is something interesting. It takes the person who has what seemingly is a good quality and corrupts it. Suddenly, and the key here is suddenly, you realize that the smart person is not better than you. Quite to the contrary. The smart person is knocked down a peg, and that new peg is below yours. When you suddenly realize that this person who is in front of you is now behind you, there's a swelling of pride in your breast. A wave of triumphant joy washes over you, and a self-satisfied laughter erupts from you. That is humor, according to Hobbes. Lest you think that the superiority theory faded away with the 17th century, a contemporary advocate is the philosopher Roger Scruton. Scruton argues that humor requires rationality. We may laugh for a whole wide range of reasons. Maybe we're being tickled. Maybe we inhaled laughing gas. But humorous laughter is a completely different sort of thing. Where laughter itself is a mere bodily reaction, humor necessarily involves the mind. This, Scruton contends, explains why only humans, and perhaps God, can be humorously amused. Animals cannot engage in humor unless they can be shown to have rationality. Humor is a state of mind, and to be in a state of mind, you need a mind, a rational mind of the sort humans possess. When we're tickled, we laugh as a response. But when something is humorous, Scruton contends, we necessarily laugh at something. Humor requires an object. That object must be a thought. Humor in this way is what philosophers call intentional. There has to be something I intend to be the case in order to be amused by it. Now, where traditionally accounts of intentionality take the object of intention to be a belief, Scruton points out that in jokes, we often take something as hypothetically true. We don't really believe that Donald Trump, Mickey Mouse, and the Pope ever walked into a bar together, but we can entertain the idea of it so that it may entertain us. So, humor is not connected to the holding of a belief. Humor involves taking a thought, which we may or may not believe, and deeming it to be ridiculous. We do not laugh when something makes sense. We do not laugh when something is completely baffling. We do not laugh when we're moved to feel pity. We laugh when something is understood to be ridiculous. We may laugh when something is both ridiculous and baffling, or is ridiculous and inspires pity, but it's the ridiculousness in these cases that generates the humorous amusement. We need to rationally see the ridiculousness in the thought to find it funny. There's an object. There's an idea in the mind of a subject. The subject rationally considers the idea and finds it ridiculous. At that point, the subject is amused by the object. The subject finds the thought funny because of the rational appreciation of the ridiculousness of the object. But a thing is ridiculous if it deserves ridicule. We often separate the ideas of ridicule and ridiculous, but the fact is that ridiculous is the adjectival form of the verb to ridicule. Scruton thinks we need to reunify these terms. When the subject is amused by the object, when we find it ridiculous, it's because the subject is heaping ridicule upon the object. Scruton points out that we hate it when people laugh at us. That means that when we are the object of ridicule, we feel demeaned. When someone laughs at us, we're being insulted. We are being diminished. Now, the obvious objection to early versions of superiority theory is that there's both laughing at and laughing with. Sometimes we love to inspire the laughter of others. We want to be the life of the party. Doesn't that mean that not all laughter comes from a sense of superiority? Doesn't the fact that there's laughing with in addition to laughing at show that superiority is not a necessary condition? Scruton can say, not so fast. In the case where you're the joker or the comedian who's inspiring laughter in others, you are the purveyor of the object of laughter. You are not the object of laughter yourself. The audience is not laughing at you. They are laughing at the idea you put in their head. The idea you conveyed is ridiculous, and they're joining you in laughing at it. By laughing at something you too thought funny, they are showing themselves to be equally superior to it. You demonstrate your superiority by seeing the ridiculousness of the object. The object is a thought. Yes, the thought may resemble you, but it's not you. It's the idea you constructed. You give that thought to the consciousnesses of those around you. Some of them show that they, too, are on your level of superiority by recognizing the ridiculousness as well. Those are the ones who laugh as you think they should. But other people don't get the joke. And what do we think of people who don't get a joke you find so incredibly funny? We think they're inferior. We tell them the joke again slowly. We overemphasize the punchline. We explain the joke to them. And if they still don't get the joke, we deem them ridiculous for not being able to see the ridiculousness of something so ridiculous. And we laugh again. This time we laugh at them. And how do they feel? Inferior. Our laughter is the laughter of the superior. So, does superiority theory work? This is philosophy. Whenever a philosopher argues for something, there will always be philosophers arguing against it. So, what are the objections to superiority theory? Francis Hutcheson was a British philosopher writing after Hobbes, and he set out four objections to the necessity and sufficiency of superiority theory. Do they work? That, of course, is your job to figure out. Welcome to philosophy. The first objection that Hutcheson lobs at superiority theory is that sometimes we laugh at that which we know to be superior to us. Hutcheson points out that there are some uproariously funny bits in Homer's Odyssey, which no one would ever say was not the work of a historical genius. It's both brilliant and at parts humorous. Homer depicts Zeus, the most powerful of the gods, as having to deal with a complaining, nitpicking wife in Hera. Even the most powerful being in existence still has to say, "Yes, dear." Homer puts the odd in Odyssey. But surely there's no one, Hutcheson says, who would consider him or herself superior to Homer. In this case, we laugh at something we admire, not something to which we feel suddenly superior. This attack is meant to show that inspiring a sense of superiority in the audience is not necessary for humorousness. Something can be humorous without giving rise to feelings of superiority. The second objection that Hutcheson sets out against superiority theory is that if superiority theory worked, then the more superior you are to something, the funnier it ought to be. But the opposite is sometimes true. Consider animal acts. It's an old saw in show business that you should never follow children or animals. Kids may say the darndest things, but animals, boy oh boy, do we find them funny. But when are animals funny? Not when they're at their beastliest. Not when they are most like animals. Animals are the funniest when they're the most like us. When animals seem human, or are made to act human, we find animals the most amusing. The organ grinder's monkey, dressed up like a human and dancing around holding a tin cup for tips, gave rise to Mr. Ed, Francis the Talking Mule, and Lancelot Link, Secret Chimp. There's a series of videos from a show on the BBC which takes clips from nature documentaries and dubs in human voices so that what were purely beastly actions are suddenly transformed into human-type actions, and we laugh. But my personal favorite is from a documentary called Animals Are Beautiful People. One scene shows a marula tree in Africa, whose fruit dropped to the ground only after it's begun to ferment. Animals of all sorts gather around the watering hole and partake vigorously of the fermented fruit. We see elephants, warthogs, wildebeests, chimps staggering about, unable to walk a straight line, falling off tree limbs. They're drunk. They look like your friends at a party on one of those nights. Animals that are usually predators and animals that are usually prey, just hanging out together, completely snookered, having a grand old time. And then the next scene is a shot of the next morning, a baboon with its head in its hands, nursing what's clearly a headache we all know all too well. It looks up with that look on its face, that morning after look, and we cannot but laugh. Again, this is an attack on the necessity of superiority. If superiority were needed, then more of it should yield more humor. But the opposite seems to be the case. Hutchison's third objection is that there seem to be cases of humor which do not involve any sort of hierarchical rankings of individuals. Sometimes we laugh on a good play of words. Some jokes are just silly fun, where one is surely not asserting any sort of superiority at all. Consider the old Borscht Belt classic. You know that God is Jewish when even the son is named Saul. Are you really going to assert your superiority over God or the son? Is there a sense of sudden glory when you realize that we can change the pronunciation of the scientific name of the son and have it sound like a nickname for Solomon? Surely you're wiser than that. This, once again, is an attack on the claim of necessity. If superiority were a necessity for humor, then it would be impossible to come up with a joke which would be recognizable as a joke and not cause the listener to feel superior. But there do seem to be plenty such jokes out there. Where the first three of Hutchison's objections are against the necessity of superiority to humor, his final objection is to claims of sufficiency. Feeling superior to another, even suddenly, he contends, does not entail humorousness. Suppose you're just cruising along. Windows open on a beautiful day. Everything's normal. Then, out of nowhere, a car cuts through the intersection, running right through a red light, plows into a school bus full of children. You're shocked. You're concerned for the injured. You're angry at the traffic infraction. You may feel many emotions. You have many thoughts. Call 911. How can I help? Oh, my goodness, I hope everyone is okay. The reason you rush in to give a hand, however, is because those in the vehicle are potentially hurt very badly, and you're not. You're in better shape than the accident victims. You realize very suddenly how inferior their position is to yours. You spring into action. What you don't do is laugh at them. There's nothing funny about a car running a red light, hitting a school bus, and lots of people, including children, having been injured. There is a sudden sense of superiority, a jolt of understanding that your lot is better than someone else's. If the superiority theory were true, and a sense of superiority were sufficient for humor, then this ought to be a funny situation. But of course, it isn't. Now, this is not to say that there are not funny tragic events. Right? The Darwin Awards, for example, were darkly funny, showing how people's, mostly men's, brash inferiority led to their undoing. Sure, sometimes we do laugh at tragedies, but not always. And that, Hutchison argues, is what the superiority theory needs. Is he right? Is superiority theory sunk? Are there parts we'll want to savage? Are there insights that will be essential to maintain? Again, Welcome to philosophy. Let's continue to look at other possibilities and see what we think is, well, superior.
Lecture 11, Inferiority Theory.
So, you always been behind the camera?
No, actually I was on TV once.
Really? Mm-hmm. What show?
Law and Order.
No way! Yeah. What was the role?
I played a corpse.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So, they could see your whole body?
Well, no, my head was supposed to be smashed in, so that was covered.
Okay, but they got to see the rest of you?
And I needed a stunt torso.
But your legs are on?
Yeah, just my legs. Really.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's all right. How about you? Have you ever been on TV?
Almost. So about 15 years ago, I made it past the first round of auditions for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, my wife made me do it. She won Who Wants to Marry a Philosopher, which is the opposite of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Nice.
Very few things will bring people together like a joke. I come from a very funny family. My grandparents, my father and his brothers, my brother, my cousins, the whole lot of us are jokers. Kibitzers, to use the Yiddish term. It's always warm and comfortable to spend time with one's family, but in our case, it's guaranteed to be a laugh riot. When everyone's gathering, whether it's a holiday or for a special occasion like a wedding, you just know you're gonna laugh. You start collecting the best jokes you've heard in the last few months. You walk in with a certain frame of mind. There's something special about being with a group of people and laughing together. Now, if we're going to try to construct a humor theory, a set of necessary and sufficient conditions that completely account for the essential properties of humor, surely this sort of interpersonal connection that derives from humor needs to be accounted for. Humor is essentially social. Telling a joke requires a joke teller and an audience, and the act requires a connection between them. Any successful account of humor will have to make sense of that aspect. Now, there was a human relationship built into our first humor theory, superiority theory, right? There's a person telling the joke, the audience for the joke, and the butt of the joke, that is, the thing or person the joke is about. When the joke starts, all these people may be on the same social level. They could be social equals, but after the joke, things are different. The teller and the audience are laughing at the butt of the joke. The butt of the joke is on the unfortunate end of the act. The butt is socially diminished, and the teller and the audience are elevated above the butt of the joke by laughing at him or her. The teller and the audience assert their superiority, the line goes, by telling the joke about the butt. But is this always the case? We saw that there were several other philosophical concerns with respect to the necessity and sufficiency of superiority theory. But what we're bringing up here is something completely different. Is the social effect of telling a joke what superiority theorists claim? Now, the philosopher Ted Cohen wrote a wonderful little book called Jokes, Philosophical Thoughts on Joking Matters. It was one of the books that put philosophy of humor on the map. It's a short, beautifully written, easy-to-read book that made it to the New York Times bestseller list. And it was there for a reason. It's a great book. In that book, one of the things he argues is that there's a special bond amongst people who share a laugh over a joke. He calls this joke intimacy. If you have a conversation with someone, you're acquaintances. But if you joke with somebody, now you're friends. Not great friends, not best friends, but there is a difference in terms of the relationship you have with someone with whom you've shared a laugh. We bond over jokes the way we do over deep shared experiences. Social scientists have found something similar that strikes many as counterintuitive. Sociologists and anthropologists have noted something surprising when it comes to joke cycles, that is, collections of jokes about a topic or a group. Take Polish jokes, long a staple of American ethnic joke collections. The major wave of Polish immigration to the United States occurred from the 19-teens to the 1930s. When Poles came to America, they faced hatred and discrimination. Fear of immigrants is nothing new in the U.S. Familiar accusations were leveled against them. They were both too lazy to be accepted as real members of the society, and they were a threat because they were taking jobs away from real Americans. They didn't speak English. They were of inferior stock. The loathing of the Polish was made known to them in a wide range of ways. You would think that one of these ways would be humor. You would think that this putting down of the Polish immigrants would be the source of the classic Polak jokes. Jokes, if you buy the superiority theory, diminish the butt of the joke and elevate the teller. This is what was intentionally happening. So, surely, Polak jokes were used as tools of oppression, right? What the social scientists have found is something quite different, something unexpected and interesting. When you examine the emergence and proliferation of ethnic jokes about a particular group, it does not match up with the period of greatest oppression. When the Polish were most targeted by formal means, laws and employment policies, and informal means, nasty comments and negative individual encounters, was not the time when there were Polish jokes in the culture. There were two periods when Polish jokes became very prominent in American culture. The first was the 1950s and 1960s, that is, a generation after the main wave of immigrants. It was not the immigrants themselves who were targeted by these jokes, but rather their children. These were kids who were assimilated, who were born in America, who were themselves Americans of Polish descent, not Polish. This is a recognized pattern that was seen again and again. The ethnic jokes were not spread when there was actual fear of the group. The jokes weren't used as weapons against the group when they were experiencing the worst of their oppression. Rather, it was once the group became assimilated. Social researchers like Christy Davis and Elliot Oring argue that the jokes are not linguistic signals, that the teller of the joke is superior to the butt of the joke. To the contrary, when the ethnic jokes about a group began is when the group was accepted into the mainstream of society. The joke cycles about the group are a social linguistic signal, but a signal that you are no longer considered the other. When you hear these jokes, you've been accepted as a part of the majority. Joking is something you do with those with whom you feel comfortable. And the fact that we're now joking about you means that you are now one of us. The majority is sending a signal of joke intimacy, not joke intimidation, with these jokes. They observed the same phenomenon with other groups associated with joke cycles, with Jews and Irish, for example. The jokes came when they were no longer outsiders, no longer a threat, no longer explicitly oppressed. Interestingly, the second wave of Polish jokes that permeated American culture occurred in the 1980s, immediately following the ordination of Pope John Paul II. A Pole was elevated to a position of international renown and universal respect. Having someone Polish in such an incredible place of honor led to a revival of Polish jokes. This was not because there was resentment and a movement to put Poles back in their place. It was part of culturally accepting the place of Poles in society. So, if I tell you this one. So, these two Poles are looking for a Christmas tree. They go out to the forest and are walking, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. Finally, one looks at the other and says, "We are going to cut down the next tree we find, whether it has lights on it or not." Now, with that joke, I'm not telling you that I think Poles are stupid. I don't. My dissertation director is Polish and smartest person I've ever met. Rather, what I'm telling you is that I feel comfortable enough with Poles to be able to tell a joke that, from the wrong person, could be misconstrued. I'm telling it because these are people I like, people I kid around with. These are my friends. One attempt to reformulate humor theory in line with this insight came from Robert Solomon, who, as you may know, also produced several philosophy lecture series for the great courses. Solomon was one of the few celebrities we've had in philosophy in recent years, a public intellectual, wonderful speaker. He was one of the few well-known philosophers in American cultural discourse. He also wrote a very fun little article called Are the Three Stooges Funny? Certainly. Or When Is It Okay to Laugh? In it, he examines why the Three Stooges are funny. Now, one might think this is a straightforward victory for the superiority theorists. If there's any example of humor that reeks of domination, surely it's the Three Stooges. Whether it's Moe poking Larry in the eye or hitting him in the head with a pipe, or Curly making a fool of himself by barking like a dog or waddling undignified in a circle while slapping himself on the head, the Stooges were surely the butt of the joke. When we laugh at the Stooges' antics in the film, we are laughing at the Stooges. Laughing at is an insult, so surely the humor of the Three Stooges is evidence in favor of the superiority theory. But not to hear Solomon tell it. According to Solomon, the reason we laugh at the Stooges is not a feeling of superiority, but quite the opposite, a feeling of empathy. The Three Stooges were Jewish immigrants, and their humor was the humor of the downtrodden. The butt of the joke in the Stooges' films were often those who were above them, especially those who were pretentious. So, who is the butt of the humor in the Three Stooges' films? Solomon notes that it's everyone in the Three Stooges films. Rich or poor, male or female, respected or oppressed, everyone gets it in the end. Sometimes, literally in the end, with something sharp. A quick aside for a little Three Stooges trivia. Did you know that the first appearance on screen of the Three Stooges was in a film called Soup to Nuts by Rube Goldberg? Yes, that Rube Goldberg. The cartoonist famous for his depictions of wacky systems designed to do normal tasks. You know, a candle burns through a string, which frees the lever, which hits a bowling ball, which rolls down the ramp, which falls into a bucket on a seesaw, which elevates the bed at an angle so the sleeper's forced to get up in the morning. That Rube Goldberg not only gave us decades of cartoons, but also the Three Stooges. Now, not everyone likes the Three Stooges, of course. Many who do not like them contend that their work's not funny because it's too violent. There's nothing funny about hurting people, and that's all they do in their stupid movies. But Solomon warns us not to confuse slapstick with violence. It's absolutely true that we should detest violence and not delight in it. But slapstick is something completely different. In Solomon's word, slapstick is the ultimate prick of pretension. We say that a pretentious person is all puffed up or full of himself. To be on the receiving end of a slapstick gag is to become deflated. You're brought back down to earth with the rest of us. The German word Schadenfreude means delighting in the suffering of others. Suppose you're driving and somebody passes you on a double yellow line, speeding, weaving, driving recklessly with an attitude. Then, a few miles down the road, you see the flashing red and blue lights of a police car that's pulled the guy over. You might laugh and wave at the aggressive driver as you pass with a smug sense that the universe has seen that justice would be served. Ha ha, he got what he deserved. This is not the sort of laughter we have when we watch The Stooges, though. We laugh at the pratfalls and slapstick gags not because we want someone brought down to size. We laugh not because we're sadistic and just like to see pain. We laugh not because we're nasty people who like to see others get hurt. To the contrary, Solomon contends that we laugh at the Three Stooges because we're good people who empathize with the butt of the joke. Solomon points out that in the films of the Three Stooges, who is it who ends up getting it? Everyone. No matter who you are, if you appear with the Three Stooges, you're gonna get it somehow, somewhere. Maybe it'll be soup in your lap, a needle in the backside, a 2x4 across the back of your head, your dress ripped off when you stand up. It's going to be something. And it's not just those in the Stooges films. It's all people. Solomon contends that the human condition is to aspire to greatness in a world that will not allow it. Humans are never satisfied. We always want more, to be better, to do what we've never done, to see what we've never seen. This is a very existentialist stance that Solomon adopts. Human beings are projects. Jean-Paul Sartre famously says that for human beings, existence precedes essence. That is, there is no human nature that shapes us. We're born blank slates